This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are heroes around you. There are men and women. They might be right next door, right down the street, around the corner, but they have some stories, the things that they've done for the sake of our freedom. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn a whole lot. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And today I'm in Visalia, California, where coming up on August 15th, they'll mark the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II with a special Spirit of 45 celebration. I'll have the privilege of speaking there. And if you're in the area, I'd love to see you there. And maybe you'll run into our guest today, who has been in Visalia for nearly four decades now. In fact, for 17 years, he was involved with the Visalia Police Department, started volunteering there later in life. But we're going to go way back to his early days outside of Detroit in Warren, Michigan. Marvin Shields, 94 years old, our guest today. Are you really 94? You don't seem like you're 94.
I don't look it either.
No, I bet you don't act it.
Well, I am.
I'll have to ask the fine folks here at Walnut Park in Visalia, where Marvin has his Navy insignia all over the place, and a Navy career that I'm sure was not what you were thinking about when you were a young, young boy growing up outside of Detroit, one of seven children. Do you remember what that was like? Because most of the people listening weren't alive for the Great Depression, but well, you experienced it there in Michigan.
When I'm about two, I was always in a sailor suit.
Really?
Yeah.
Where'd that come from? Was your father in the Navy or something?
No, he was in the Army.
Yeah?
World War One.
Uh-huh. But you, for some reason, you're in a sailor suit. Was it because of the Great Lakes nearby? Or?
No. Just my mother bought me my first sailor suit and everything. I always wanted to be in the police department, fire department, and some jobs like that through my whole life, and I completed them too.
I guess you did, yeah. You're a firefighter in Detroit and on a police force here.
And then I was in a juvenile hall here, and I say I was there for 3 or 4 years, and I just kept busy all my life.
You've worn a lot of hats, not just that sailor hat. You mentioned your father in the Army in World War One. How much do you know about what he did during that war?
He never talked about it, but in the other room I have a picture of him in his Army uniform, and he got discharged for flat feet.
Mm.
He got a medical discharge.
Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe you wouldn't have been born otherwise.
Yeah, probably.
So you're born almost a New Year's baby. The very end of 1920 is when you came into this world. But those growing up years, those times that were so tough for our country in the early 1930s especially, how did you experience that there in Michigan?
Well, the Depression was about that time, too.
That's what I mean. What was that like? Can you give us a taste of what life was like then?
We lost our house in Detroit and then traded a house out in the country for a good house in Detroit. That's the only way we survived. And I just went to pick up places to pick up fish and peanut butter and apple butter and stuff like that. But when we made a sandwich, we made it with lard, then salt and pepper, and then closed the sandwich and that's how we ate them days.
That's all you had?
Yeah.
A little lard, a little salt, a little pepper.
Mm-hmm.
No meat, no produce, none of that.
Well, we had to eat and survived the way, but I went into the CC camps in my 12th grade. I never graduated then.
Mm. And was that because you needed to make money for the family?
Yeah.
Yeah.
See, I was the first boy to go to the CC camps. We made $30 a month. We had to send 22 home. And the $8 for expenses and stuff I needed at camp. But then my brother Norman behind me, he went to another camp. And then my brother Frank Jr., he went to another camp. So that was $66 my mother got to save our house.
Wow. That puts things in perspective. So many people today have no idea what life was like back. And most of the people listening were not born while all this was going on. And so the Civilian Conservation Corps, they had these camps, and there would be different jobs that you could do. All the stories I've heard, it's pretty intensive labor. What was the kind of stuff that you were doing?
When I was 16, I was driving a dump truck. Yeah, I'm building roads and stuff like that. But that's when I was 16. And then the weather didn't bother me at all. I just wore a sweater with a V-neck and a wool sweater on, and off I went.
Snow or otherwise?
Yeah, it's up in the Whitefish Point up in there, yeah.
Woo.
Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan.
Yeah, that's pretty far north. One question I like to ask every veteran, because every veteran seems to have a pretty clear recollection of it. December 7th, 1941. Do you remember where you were and how you heard?
Yes. We were sitting around the table. My father, two of my buddies, and myself playing pinochle when it came over the radio. So we all stood up, couldn't figure what the heck was going on. But then I went down to the federal building in Detroit the next day, and I wasn't quite 21. I had a draft number, and I wasn't going to use that in the Army or Marines or anything. So I went down and volunteered for the Navy.
What was it that compelled you to do that? What made you want to go be a part of this?
Well, they were getting pretty close to us. I mean, the Japs were between Pearl Harbor and us.
Mm-hmm. Here your father had fought what they called the war to end all wars, and now here's his son getting into another war.
Yeah.
Just 20 years later.
Yeah.
Do you remember what you expected out of the Navy, what you thought it was going to be like?
I thought it was just going to be, we got to hold them back. We weren't going to let them land on our shores and be any part of us.
So you were pretty motivated by what had happened at Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, but then, see, 20 days later, after my mother got me back out of the Navy, I went the next day after the 29th of December. I was 21. At that time, they were taking rated people, like truck drivers, machinists, Air Corps people. They were just starting with 38 down.
Mm-hmm.
So my uncle went. He was 38 then, and he was over in Midway. But then I went through in a rated company because I'd done paramedic work and I was with fire department. That's why I went through so fast. And in 2 months, I was through boot camp and everything with the rated company and out to the Mount Vernon. You know that ship?
That's the troop ship, right?
Yeah.
How was it that you ended up on the USS Pensacola?
They got torpedoed and they went into got partial repair.
Right. So the Pensacola was hit. This is off of Guadalcanal.
Yes.
They call it the Battle of Tassafaronga.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was one of the American ships that took heavy damage there, was repaired at Tulagi.
Yeah, that's Tulagi.
And ended up by January of 43 at Pearl Harbor.
Yeah.
Is that where you got aboard?
Yeah, because I was already assigned to that ship before she got hit.
So you knew you were going to be on the Pensacola,
yeah,
but you weren't on her yet.
Oh, no.
And then you find out she just got torpedoed.
Yeah, but then they put me aboard the troop ship going to Australia.
Uh-huh.
And New Zealand. And so for about 6-7 months, I just worked on that troop ship.
The Mount Vernon.
Yeah, and we always travel alone across the ocean because we were faster than the battle wagons,
right,
and aircraft carriers. So we had to change course every 7 minutes out there.
You're zigzagging to miss the subs. Well, let's talk about the Pensacola. You were on the Pensacola for the Battle of Midway?
Yep. Tuawa, Gilbert's, the Sullivan Islands, and right on through all of them.
Yeah. Iwo Jima?
Oh, yeah. We got hit there, too. I was in the fire room then. See, if I wasn't in the fire room, I'd have been on a 5-inch gun.
What do you remember about Midway? What were you doing? You were on that 5-inch gun crew then?
If I wasn't on duty. See, we were on 4-on and 4-off, 4-on and 4-off. All around the clock, 7 days a week.
So what was your duty?
Well, I started out as a water tender for third class.
Uh-huh.
Then I went to second class and first class. When I ended up, when the war ended, everything stopped for me.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the hospital in Vallejo, California. Malaria, different things, skin cancer.
Mare Island. My show last week was with a lady who was a nurse at Mare Island Naval Hospital.
My wife was too.
Really? So that's how you met your wife, in the hospital?
Yeah.
So you talked about starting out water tender, third class and all that. For the people that don't have any Navy experience, can you explain to everybody what that means?
Well, it's a boiler room on the Pensacola. There's 4 boiler rooms forward and 4 after, an engine room between them, and we had to keep the fires in the boilers.
Mm-hmm.
To form steam for the ship to go ahead.
Then general quarters sounds, and what happens?
If you're locked in a position where you're on duty,
mm-hmm,
you got to stay there over like maybe 6 hours instead of 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Then you'd be on the guns the other time.
And the gun that you would go to was a 5-inch gun?
5-inch gun.
That's a big gun.
Yeah.
That's a loud gun. And what would you do on that gun crew?
Be a pointer. Pointer and a trainer.
One is vertical, one's horizontal?
Yeah, up and down, yeah, across.
So your job is to get the elevation of the gun right?
Or the aircraft or we're shooting at.
Mm-hmm.
Or the shoreline, whatever we're shooting on.
And you're working in unison with how many other guys on that gun crew?
We had people lifting shells up to us, you know, from the holes. Rammer would ram the shell in and then the bag powder behind it. And about 6 or 7 on the floor deck, yeah.
Do you remember the first time that you had to go man that gun when this was really happening and you were in the thick of it?
We practiced almost every day.
Practice?
Yeah.
But what about the first time it wasn't practice and it was for real? Was that at Midway?
Yeah.
The Battle of Midway is a huge, huge moment in World War II. Big turning point.
Yeah.
You were part of it.
Yeah.
There aren't very many guys around anymore that were part of it. What can you tell us, those who weren't there, about what you saw there, the kinds of things, the scope of it, what you experienced?
Well, we had to stay out on a ship. We never got ashore.
But that's where all the fighting was, on the ships.
Yeah.
There's planes in the sky, right?
Yeah, they went right, and our plane's right behind them.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a stack here and a stack there just flying right through our, and we shot maybe a couple of our own planes down too.
Yeah, this is a chaotic scene.
Yeah.
You've got all these American ships, all these Japanese ships, all these airplanes in the sky, all these guns going off, bombs being dropped.
You couldn't see through the ack-ack that was up in the sky when them planes went through them and, mm-hmm. or when they come in.
Just clouds of black from all the anti-aircraft artillery.
Yeah, it looked like a polka dot.
Uh-huh.
Polka dot sky.
And you're on the 5-inch gun?
Yeah.
Trying to shoot at some of those planes?
Yeah. So, you know, I never actually shot anybody there. I don't know how many shells that we fired
mm-hmm.
may have killed somebody. So I can't say whether I did or didn't kill anybody.
But what was that like? I mean, you're just a 21-year-old kid. Was that scary?
Everything's scary. I mean, even Chihuahua was one of the worst battles we had. I had a couple people from me when I was in a CC camp from Detroit. We fished them out of the water.
At Tarawa? I want to get to that. Let's finish up Midway just because of how pivotal it was, and so we can understand the Pensacola's role here. Because one of the reasons that battle was so successful is the Japanese carriers that the American forces sunk. But the Japanese also sank an American carrier, the Yorktown.
Yeah.
And as I understand it, the job of your ship was to help protect those American carriers, right?
Oh, yeah. There were no battle wagons around then.
Right. So you guys were heavy, the biggest thing going to defend them.
Heavy cruisers, yeah. Then the light cruisers behind us.
So it's not like you were on the perimeter out of the action. You guys were right in the middle of all the action.
We never noticed it then. Fire every day.
I'm just trying to imagine what that must have felt like for you. 21 years old. Out here in the middle of the ocean.
I would tell you that the CC camps, when I had to leave in the 12th grade to save our home.
That prepared you?
Yeah, I turned into a man then. I was a boy playing football and baseball for the school and that. And,
mm-hmm.
But that CC camps made a man out of me. And I wasn't scared of anything then. I drove a dump truck for gravel and that, making roads and pulling logs out of the woods and that. Yeah, it made a man out of me then.
And you're still going strong at 94. It's pretty eye-opening, isn't it? If you're like me and you weren't born yet, you didn't live through the Great Depression, you didn't experience anything like the CCC camps Mr. Shields was talking about, that Civilian Conservation Corps was part of FDR's New Deal. Mr. Shields entered the program so his family could save its home. And hearing him share that memory of it makes me wonder how many others were in the CCC for similar reasons. How much the experience men had in those difficult situations prepared them for what they'd be facing in a worldwide war. 300,000 was the most that were in the CCC program at any one time. But over the 9 years that the program operated until it was disbanded in June of 1942, more than 9 million young men participated. 16 million Americans would end up serving in uniform in World War II, and for Sailor Marvin Shields, that meant an up-close view of some of the Pacific's most crucial battles aboard the heavy cruiser USS Pensacola. Check out the photos at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. If you live anywhere near Visalia, California, plan on meeting Mr. Shields on Saturday, August 15th at an event commemorating the 70th anniversary of the end of World War II. just trying to keep that spirit of 45 alive. I'll tell you more about that effort, and we'll get the rest of Marvin Shields' story when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
You know, one of the things I appreciate so much about the veterans we meet on Hometown Heroes is that they're real. A sincere and genuine spirit really makes an impression on me, and that's why I'm such a big fan of Educational Employees Credit Union. It was EECU that spearheaded the launch of Central Valley Honor Flight with an initial donation of close to $25,000, and the giving did not end there. More than 200,000 members know EECU represents smarter banking, but it's not just about being smart, it's about the heart. I've worked with the folks at EECU for years, and I've watched them put their money where their mouth is, supporting their credit union members right where they live in hometowns up and down Central California. From sponsoring first-class Educator of the Year ceremonies to taking the lead in sending World War II veterans on an unforgettable journey, my friends at EECU keep proving that you are at the heart of everything they do. Go to myeecu.org to see what EECU can do for you, or just walk into any branch. And while you're there, if you enjoy this show, tell them thanks for supporting Hometown Heroes.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 94-year-old Marvin Shields of Visalia, California, a Navy veteran of World War II. He served on the troop transport USS Mount Vernon before joining the crew of the heavy cruiser USS Pensacola. You'll find some photos and even a little video of Mr. Shields on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. Even a photo of him in a sailor suit as a toddler. Guess that destiny was clear early on. We heard about how he grew up in Michigan, one of seven children. Two of his brothers also served in World War II. Marvin had to give up his senior year of high school to go to a civilian conservation corps camp, sending most of the money he earned home so his family wouldn't lose its home. He'd experienced some of the most intense battles of the Pacific aboard the USS Pensacola, but he insists he wasn't scared, just motivated to stop the Japanese from coming to the American mainland.
My life had been life, but and my brothers, they survived too.
There had to be some moments where you weren't sure you were going to survive.
We didn't care then.
Yeah. Well, and I know folks who know you here in Visalia, a lot of them know you from church. I know you're in Grace every Sunday. Is that a faith that you had at that time?
No, I was a Catholic then.
Yeah? Did you have a feeling, though, that God was going to protect you out there? Not so much.
No, I couldn't figure why it was happening that a person was a tap dancer, he lost his legs. A person that sings had lost his head. I mean, it was a standing thing then.
Didn't seem fair.
No.
Did you always believe you were going to make it through?
No, but I made it known that if I was crippled, I wouldn't come back.
Hmm.
Even after a while, I wouldn't want to be an amputee.
And I'm sure that from midway on, you saw a lot of guys in those kind of conditions.
Well, them two guys that were in the CC camps with me, we hooked them out of the water, and that was Orlin Romano. And another guy was with us then.
So what you're talking about now is Tarawa, which is often overlooked. People talk a lot about Iwo Jima, and you were there too. We'll talk about it. But Tarawa was really devastating for the amount of American casualties they were, capturing a very small portion of land. And the Marine Corps learned a lot of lessons there about blowing up reefs before they went in because so many got hung up.
We used, I think, the British maps to get in there. And we run aground halfway in. We couldn't get back out, and you can't go any further.
Mm-hmm.
They just picked us off in the bunkers they had there.
I guess maybe this is something to try to understand. What was it like when the enemy planes were coming at your ship?
There was a lot of other ships there, too.
Right.
I mean, we had DDs and DEs and all of them behind us, and we had picket ships on the outskirts, and so we knew where they were coming. But we've done our best.
That ever strike you, the magnitude of all this, of just how massive these forces were?
I thought we were better. If there would have been aircraft carriers in Pearl Harbor when they bombed the battleships, then it would have been a different war.
Yeah.
But all of our aircraft carriers were out to sea.
Yeah.
Except Saratoga was in dry dock.
So this incident that you describe at Tarawa, explain the situation to me, where you guys, you pulled up two guys and you happen to know who they were?
Yeah, they were in the CC camps with me in 1939.
But tell me what happened, how you guys found them.
They were floating in the water. The LSTs that went in were stuck on the sand barriers.
Uh-huh.
And they couldn't back up. They couldn't go forward. So they were just picked to hell.
Right. So these guys had been shot somewhere in there, and you happened to bring the bodies aboard your ship?
Yeah, our ship, yeah.
And you were topside?
Yeah.
And you recognized these two faces?
Orin Moreno, I did.
What was that like for you?
He was a joker of the crowd and all that. And, it was just bring him up and lay him aside. And
is that hard to believe that this guy they're pulling up is a guy you knew?
Yeah.
I mean, of all the people in the war, that's quite a coincidence, isn't it?
Well, even when I went aboard the troop ship, I heard a voice in the next room, and I recognized that voice. And he was from forestry. He studies forestry in Michigan or Michigan State.
Huh.
But I knew that voice. And so when I went in around the corner there to look in on him, that was our chaplain.
Huh. Small world. When you're at Tarawa and they pull up a guy that you know.
Yeah.
How did that make you feel?
Who's next?
Maybe you. Yeah. How did you deal with that at the time, that reality?
I wasn't shaken or anything like that. War is war, and part of us would die and part wouldn't. Yeah, then from there we went on to Kwajalein and Anwatok and all the little islands like Wochi.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a crew division our own about that time called Chester was the first, then us, and then the Salt Lake City behind us. We always traveled like three. Next morning we'd wake up, find only two of us. We didn't know what happened to the other ship.
Mm.
But it went another way, and then we went another way, and we never always traveled as a group.
So basically, the role that you played during this time, as I understand it, is yours. And you mentioned some of those spots where you were throughout the Pacific, but your ship actually went quite a ways north, didn't it?
You mean Bering Sea?
Yeah, that's pretty far north. How did you go from Tarawa and Kwajalein and these places all the way to the very northern reaches of the Pacific and the Bering Sea?
Well, we traveled in there alone.
Uh-huh.
See, up in Alaska, we had destroyers that could operate good in that water,
mm-hmm.
like the Detroiter and the Raleigh and the Concord. And there was five of them up there with four stacks. We had two stacks.
Mm-hmm.
But they could operate in that water. Yeah, we went down there and we stayed in a fog bank for 2 days with Russian planes overhead circling us. And we stayed in that for 2 days. And when one plane left, another plane was there. So they knew where we were, and they couldn't see us, but we knew where they were, too.
The Russians were keeping their eyes on you.
And if they would have caught us crossing the Bering Sea, they would have interned us.
You think so?
Oh, yeah. We crossed their waters. See, we own part of that Bering Sea, and then they own the other part.
So you're up there near Alaska, and then you turn around, and you go all the way back down to Hawaii.
Yeah, one day we're wearing a whole sea bag to keep warm. Chipping ice on the ship, and then next day we're in our sunsuits again, shorts and that, laying on the deck at night. And so,
do you ever wonder who was calling those shots?
I don't know who was.
And then before too long, you guys were out shelling places like Iwo Jima and Saipan.
Yeah, Ulithi, and that was a round base where all our ships got in and stayed there until it was they formed a party to travel. So we were actually, by Tokyo Rose, we were actually sunk six times.
Only six?
Yeah.
Is that why she called you the Gray Ghost?
Yeah, I didn't know that. Galloping Ghost and Gray Ghost.
That was the nickname that Tokyo Rose, the Japanese propagandist, gave your ship. I guess maybe to cover her own behind, because she kept saying that you had sunk, huh?
Yeah. Well, they thought we sunk, but we didn't get really hit too bad in a lot of them battles. But when we got to Iwo, that's when we got it.
Well, let's talk about that. But first, tell me about Tokyo Rose. Did you actually hear her any of her broadcasts where she was talking about you guys?
Yeah, on the ship. Yeah.
So you're on your ship. Yeah. And listening to her say that your ship has sunk.
Yeah, they tapped a little letter, and then we read the letter and that.
How did you react to that?
We laughed. We laughed because the next day we're at another island in a group, Lake Wolgie, Chester. And then us, and then Salt Lake City, all three of us bombed that one island that day. So we turned our gun onto another small island. I think I've got the picture in there of blowing that island up. That's where they carried the ammunition, in that little island. And the one we were bombing, they didn't have ammunition.
Well, I guess when you hear Tokyo Rose say that you've sunk and you know you haven't, then you know not to take anything else she says seriously.
For granted, yeah.
You said a moment ago that Iwo Jima is where things got dicey. Tell me about that. What did you experience? What did you see?
Well, at that time, the three heavy cruisers, Chester, us, and Salt Lake City, we had flocks of boats. It looked like a polka dot setting there.
Mm-hmm.
The three cruisers, the Chester, go around the outskirts, low speed. We had to have, in our boilers, we have different tips for flare. We were at our low 19s on to travel real slow to creep along this island and try and draw their fire. The second day, we went around, and nothing happened, driving slow along the coast, and they had caves up there.
Yeah.
Had railroad tracks in them caves and everything to bring guns up. So the next day, the Chester came. So then the fourth day, Salt Lake City came, then the Chester came, and the fifth day, we came, slow.
Mm-hmm.
I got pictures in that, too, how we got we took six shells into us from them guns in the caves there.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't fire till the fifth day, and we lost quite a few men then.
Those six hits, that happened once the invasion actually was taking place, right? But as I understand it, you guys really for a couple of months went to Iwo several times to shell the island. Because the invasion doesn't happen until mid-February of 45, yeah. But you guys have been there in December of 44 and January of 45.
And like I say, a couple of times we took and divided our cruiser division. Where the Salt Lake went one way and Chester another way.
But once the invasion starts in the middle of February, this is what you're talking about. You guys are circling the island.
Yeah, yeah.
And you took six hits from the Japanese guns on Iwo Jima. Three officers and 14 men were killed.
Yeah. I think it was 17 men but actually killed.
Right, with the three officers and the 14 enlisted. Yeah. So that's 17 men killed and then almost 120 more injured. You must have seen some of that.
We felt it.
How close were you to some of those hits?
I was down in the boiler room.
You're down in the boiler room, so you feel this ship shaking.
Oh, yeah. Sturdivant air vents or fans up there. A couple pellets come down through there.
Really? So some of the shrapnel from these shore guns actually came down to where you were in the boiler.
That's three decks down.
That's got to be pretty scary.
It was all do or die.
You don't know what else is coming, right? One of those hits, you wonder when the next one's going to hit?
Well, we never felt a couple decks down.
Yeah.
But it was bad when we got out. I've got pictures here of it on fire.
We're talking about Iwo Jima, and I imagine that's one of the closest calls you had.
Yeah.
When your ship got hit six times, but you weren't one of the men who was hurt by that.
No.
But while you were still there, you saw some things that millions of people have seen photographs of or maybe even some moving film of, but you actually saw in the moment when it happened. That flag on top of Mount Suribachi?
Yeah, I was looking through a 5-inch gun, a scope on a 5-inch gun, when that first flag went up, the small flag.
The smaller flag.
Yeah. I was just looking at the Marines going up there, and then I think there was a photographer from Hollywood or something with them.
With the second group.
Yeah, with Rosenthal.
Joe Rosenthal took the world-famous photo of the second flag that went up.
Yeah.
And you saw that one, too.
Yeah, after, it was up there quite a bit later.
And we'll try to explain some of that when we come back. It's break time again for now. If you're a regular listener to Hometown Heroes, no doubt you've heard the story of why there were two different flag raisings on Iwo Jima's Mount Suribachi. If you're not familiar with that, we'll give it to you in a nutshell and find out what that sight meant to a young sailor named Marvin Shields and how it felt to visit Washington, D.C. recently and see that scene preserved in bronze at the Marine Corps Memorial. Navy veteran Marvin Shields, our guest today, and he'll bring us down the home stretch when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our conversation with 94-year-old Marvin Shields of Visalia, California, originally from Warren, Michigan. When we left off, he told us how looking through the sight on a 5-inch gun aboard the heavy cruiser USS Pensacola, he had seen both the first flag atop Iwo Jima's Mount Suribachi and also the second flag. Maybe you didn't realize there were two flags. Maybe you thought the famous Joe Rosenthal photograph, one of the most widely viewed images in history, was the only flag that went up there. If so, here's a brief explanation for you. The Battle of Iwo Jima lasted from February 19th to March 26th of 1945. Mr. Shields and the Pensacola were there bombarding Iwo before the troops ever hit the shore. On February 23rd, at about 10:20 a.m., a combat patrol of U.S. Marines made it to the top of Mount Suribachi. They had brought along a flag that was only about 4.5 feet by 2 1/3 feet, and when they reached the summit, they put that flag on a pipe and stuck it in the ground. The Secretary of the Navy, James Forrestal, happened to have just hit the beach below Suribachi when that flag went up. He saw it, and he wanted the flag as a memento. Chandler Johnson, commander of the 2nd Marine Battalion, wasn't about to let that happen, so he sent orders to secure that first flag ASAP and have a second, bigger flag sent up to the top of the mountain. That's the one you see in the famous photo. What many don't know is that the first flag was also photographed by a man named Lewis Lowry, who was working for Leatherneck magazine. In fact, the story goes that Lowry was coming down Mount Suribachi while Rosenthal was headed up. Rosenthal and his group almost turned around and went back down, but Lowry told them the summit was a great vantage point for photographs. The rest is history, but the harsh reality of that history is that three of the six men shown raising that flag did not survive the Battle of Iwo Jima. There's a little background for you. Now let's get back to our guest Marvin Shields. He didn't know any of that backstory. He just saw the flags up there, a smaller one than that second bigger one. And when you saw that, what did it mean to you?
We captured it. We captured that island. And
that was a big deal to you?
Oh, yeah.
You didn't know how much battle was left and how many Marines would die taking that island, but seeing that flag up there meant something to you.
Oh, yeah.
Can you help us understand what you got from that? Did you feel a rush of emotion or adrenaline?
No, because they were firing at us and we were firing at them.
Well, maybe here's the question I need to ask you. A little more recently than 70 years ago, just in the last year, you had the opportunity to go to Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight. You visited the National World War II Memorial, which I know is very powerful.
This April.
Yeah. But you also got to see the Marine Corps Memorial and that statue of Marines atop Mount Suribachi with a flag in their hand. What did that mean to you to see that spot?
What fazed me most of all of them, the honor guard, the changing the guard that day, I enjoyed that real well.
At the Tomb of the Unknown.
Yeah, but they really fazed me, the Korean War, the statues coming to the field.
Yep.
They looking at each other's back. That fazed me real. They look so alive. You see the pupils of their eyes.
You almost feel what they went through?
Well, they look like they're watching each other's back.
Yeah. What did you think of when you looked at that World War II memorial and they've got all those gold stars representing 400,000 who died in World War II? Does that number weigh on you? 406,000 Americans?
No.
But you're glad you didn't add to that number.
No.
Anything else from your time at Iwo Jima that stands out to you?
No, it wasn't after that before we went to Okinawa.
Right.
I was put aboard a ship. I was hauled back to the States and put in a Mare Island hospital.
Because of malaria. So was that the first time you had malaria?
Well, I had it twice that month.
Most people listening have never experienced malaria. What does it do to you? What did it do to you 70 years ago?
You get cold. You can put every blanket or everything on you. You're still cold. You shake. I remember traveling with an ambulance, too, picking other people along the road. And I was just, there's no control. You're just phased out, shaking, can't get warm.
Pretty helpless feeling?
Yeah, but then when they give me the shots when I was in the hospital, they give it in the hip here. I was in top bunk, and you sleep right through it.
So you got off the Pensacola before it was involved at Okinawa?
Okinawa, yeah. That only lasted a week or two, I think.
Yeah, but it had some close calls at Okinawa. Some torpedoes almost got the Pensacola at Okinawa. So maybe it's a good thing you got off the ship. And I know you think it's a good thing you got malaria, right?
I think the Lord was watching my guide all along.
When I say that I know you're glad you got malaria, some people are listening and saying, what in the world is he talking about? But there's a really important reason that you needed to have malaria, because that's what put you in Mare Island Naval Hospital.
Yeah.
If you weren't in Mare Island Naval Hospital, you wouldn't have met your wife. Tell me how you met your wife.
She met me.
She met you. You didn't meet her. How did it happen? Give me the story.
No, I'm not going to bring that out.
Was she taking care of you? Were you her patient?
I was one of them.
You were one of her patients.
Mm-hmm.
She probably had a lot of patients that thought she was kind of cute.
Yeah, she was cute.
How'd you rise to the cream of the crop? How'd you get
her
attention?
I don't know, but we were married 52 years.
You must have done something that made an impression.
Oh, my travels after the war helped a lot. She was a divorcee at the time.
Mm-hmm. But have you ever thought about that? That if you wouldn't have gotten malaria, you wouldn't have been in the hospital to meet her?
But there was so many things wrong with me. 4 years down below in the fire decks and that, fire rooms. I was just glad to get out. I was glad to get in, damn glad to get out.
Yeah. Took a toll on you.
Yeah. And I was 175 pounds when I was playing football. And when I got discharged, I was 133 pounds.
Whew.
I was skin and bones.
What was all that from? What was the biggest challenge? Is that malaria?
No, I had other sicknesses too. I was in the McClellanfield Hospital. I was in the Ship's Hospital. Well, and then I was in Hawaii Hospital. But I was pretty sickly then. So just run down.
And you said a moment ago that you felt that God was always watching out for you. What are circumstances from the war where you look back and feel that was really the case?
I figured, why am I still alive? People around me were burying them every so often from ship, put old iron and stuff in the wrappings and dump them overboard.
Burial at sea is a pretty somber occasion, isn't it?
Yeah, if you die during the daytime, you're buried at night, and if you're dying during the night, you're buried in the morning.
Does that desensitize you at all to it when it happens so often?
I got used to it.
Maybe this isn't an easy question to answer, but what would you say was your closest call, the closest you came to not coming home?
I had a picture. I was going from duty to my gun, and there's a jet plane over the... We hung our bedding on the rails so we wouldn't get a lot of flak.
Mm-hmm.
So this plane came past us, and the Jap looked at us and went on. And he crashed into another ship over there. I looked at him, and he looked at me.
You're on the deck on the way to your gun. There's a kamikaze pilot within range of your ship.
Well, and when I was coming out the door, he looked at me, and I looked at him over top of these beddings hanging on the rails. And he kind of waved like that and then smashed.
He knew he was about to die.
Oh, he that was meant to die then.
But his decision could have cost you your life had he gone into your ship.
Oh, yeah.
But he went to another ship. I guess that's close enough.
Yeah, that's a couple of seconds apart.
That experience on the honor flight with all those other World War II veterans you went with, what did that mean to you? What did it do for you? What did it tell you?
What it meant to me is kids and people are so nice. Kids 9, 10, 11, shaking your hands, you're going through the... Well, I was on a walker then, so they would reach way out the crowd, you know, and shake hands. And they're so nice, and they got letters there that they wrote to us aboard ship and that. I'm saving them and probably take them with me when I die. Yeah, I've got letters in there from the kids in Fresno and all.
Yeah, and you got letters from family members and people who knew you, but you're talking about letters from people you never met.
Yeah.
That are writing to you saying, thank you for what you did. And that's meaningful to you.
Yeah. They were so gracious. I mean, I didn't see a bad kid in a whole bunch.
Did it make you feel like somebody got it? Somebody understood?
Oh, yeah. They were crying.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they had handkerchiefs out and everything.
Did it make you feel like you did something worthwhile?
Yeah.
What are you most proud of with regard to your time in the Navy?
That I got back, and my brothers got back. 3 different war zones, and all of us came back.
Mm-hmm.
I got my picture and my 3 brothers over there.
Well, before I forget, I want to say thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a little bit about it. What keeps you going?
I don't know. But I hope to live to be 100.
Yeah? Well, how are you going to celebrate when you hit 100?
Tap dance.
You still tap dancing?
No, I got one leg.
But you'll learn for that occasion.
I'll tap dance on one leg if I live that long.
Here's a tough question. You lived through World War II. You spent most of the war in the Navy. What do you think the rest of us need to know, those of us who weren't alive during World War II? What do we need to know about you and all the guys you served with?
Just keep on thinking of us. Just keep on thinking we were there.
Is there one engagement that you were involved in that you look back on and say, that really made a difference?
Yeah, we're getting pretty close to the end of the war then, but I didn't like us dropping the atomic bomb.
Why not?
The innocent children, civilians, because it was meant to be dropped one place, that was fogged in.
Yeah.
So they went and dropped it another place. They said it'd last another couple of years, but we're already in Japan.
That's a tough one. Did it save more lives than it took?
Yeah.
But would have those been combatant lives and not civilian lives? I hear you. Was there anything else I didn't ask you about that you think people ought to know?
Well, I was a loner during the war, too. When I was on duty, I was strict.
Mm-hmm.
Off duty, I was the best guy to be with on liberty. What hurt me is the day the war ended, whether we're still being treated for malaria or whatever, skin cancer and stuff like that, they emptied the hospitals.
Mm.
They gave me 30% disability.
Mm-hmm. I guess the last question I have for you is, what would you say is the most important thing you got from your time in the Navy?
It would be my discharge, for one thing. I finished my high school out while I was in the Navy. Mm. In general quarters, I'd be studying to the Madison, Wisconsin University.
Oh, okay.
So when I came out of the service, I walked across the stage to get my diploma. I was 25. They thought I was a janitor.
That's great.
I was 25 when I got my diploma.
And now he's just months away from 95. Marvin Shields of Visalia, California. Again, you have a chance to meet him and quite a few other World War II veterans in Visalia on August 15th. It's one of a series of events all over the country as part of the campaign to keep the spirit of 45 alive. If you go to spiritof45.org, that's spiritof45.org, I also have that linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. You'll find a list of events marking 70 years since the end of World War II. These are events all over the country. For example, if you're one of our friends listening on KYKN in Salem, Oregon, a six-city concert tour across the state of Oregon starts in Salem on August 9th, and that information is there online. Wherever you're listening today, there's a good chance there's a Spirit of 45 event or two or three of them in your area. And if you do happen to be somewhere near Visalia, California on August 15th, I hope you'll come because I'll be there speaking. Mr. Shields, quite a few other vets will be on hand. A 16-piece 1940s band is going to play. All the proceeds from the evening will support Central Valley Honor Flight, part of the National Honor Flight Network, sending our veterans to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. We're out of time on Hometown Heroes today, but maybe I'll see you there on August 15th as we celebrate an era of our history that underscores that simple truth I try to share with you each week. Freedom is not free.